Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here. Sunday morning wake-up call. Thanks. Our topic today is depression, and we're here today to explain it a little bit, help folks who are in need, families. And we're here with folks who have worked on it for a lot of time, Dr. Kim Penberthy. She's a professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences, co-director, physician, clinical and evaluation program, University of Virginia School of Medicine, and a book, Persistent Depressive Disorders. That's a lot. How do you carry that all around?
Well, it takes practice and a lot of hard work. I'm really happy to be here, though, Rick, so thank you for addressing this really important topic.
We also have Dr. Niall Wagley. He's a licensed clinical psychologist, set up his own organization, Rational Therapeutics, founded in 2012, also taught courses at University of Virginia and VCU. You can find the organization at www.rational-therapeutics.com, correct?
That's it. Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate this. So we have a professor, correct?
That's right.
We have a licensed clinical psychologist who've worked together and are here today to explain things, talk about this to the individual, to the families, to those of us who are ignorant. And so let's get going. I want to learn a little bit more about depression itself, because it has this stereotype, right, of someone who's sad, can't get out of bed, doesn't want to do anything. I want to know who suffers and how it's defined and some of the myths that are those things that fall into those categories. Could the two of you go back and forth and share that information?
Absolutely. So, Rick, I'd like to first of all point out I am a professor in the Department of Psychiatry, and I'm also a clinical psychologist, a licensed clinical psychologist, board certified. And as such, I work with patients and family members. So patients who suffer from depression, depression symptoms. And I know Niall, Dr. Wagley, does the same. So I think the big differences are settings. I'm at the hospital there in the School of Medicine at the University of Virginia, and Niall is out in the environment in the community. And so we may see people who are a little bit different, but all of whom suffer from depression.
And I can jump in and start with your definition and maybe break it down a little bit. One of the things I noticed about what you said is folks who don't want to get out of bed. And that's a big place to start to differentiate and talk about this. This is not about willpower. This is not about a person being a good person or a bad person. This is not about a person being a lazy person. And people get that mixed up a lot. This is a medical condition that has neurological, environmental, behavioral, psychological components that's way beyond willpower.
That's an excellent point. I think it's important to remember what we're talking about, the people that we work with and the family members we work with of those patients are really suffering from what we would classify as a medical disease. So these are folks who have potentially all of the combinations of things that we think of that would make you vulnerable to suffer from depression. So they might have a genetic component, And this is why they may use medications. They might have a history of some things that have created challenges and difficulties for them that make them vulnerable. So these are people who really have impairments in their functioning. They are not functioning the way the rest of the folks who don't suffer from depression can function.
And that's different from sadness. Sadness is a human emotion that when we lose something, sadness happens automatically. We don't get to choose it. We don't get to pick. There's a utility to it. There's a purpose for it. It's supposed to happen. That's different than the disease of depression. That's not supposed to happen. That's a problem and something that we want to talk about, some things that can be done about it today. I guess I would add in, there is some truth to the stereotypes that you were talking about, though. Depression has fatigue. They are fatigued. It is very difficult to get out of bed. Things that used to be fun actually don't feel fun anymore. Sleeping suffers. Appetite suffers. That's what depression looks like. Those are the symptoms.
So let's, again, to continue with some of the stereotypes and myths. And I'm going to take on some roles that I don't want to get me in trouble, but might. And so let's please say that they are, I'm just playing a role here. But if someone has depression, why would I hire them? Why would I be an employer of someone who has depression, who doesn't want to, who is, fulfills some of the issues that Dr. Wagley, you just described? Dr. Penberthy, you mentioned, who doesn't sound like a good coworker. Doesn't sound like someone who would be excited to come to work or be at work, whether it's with others or even for themselves.
I can address that. The main reason that you would want to hire someone with depression is because you want to have employees. Depression strikes almost everyone at some point in their life. This is not a condition that, though there are long-term people who suffer from depression for long periods of time, everyone has bouts of depression at different levels throughout their lives. You won't have any employees if you choose not to hire anyone who has depression.
And I would offer, if we think about the medical model, that would be like saying, well, why should I hire anyone with diabetes or anyone with high blood pressure? So the reality is it's a treatable disorder. And the whole goal would be for this individual to get treatment, just like they would for diabetes or for their blood pressure, and in which case they become very valuable employees. And so, you know, I think that is a myth that these folks sort of run into. And so I'm really glad you brought that up. I think the other myth, if I might jump ahead, that comes up a lot in the families and in the individuals I work with is that somehow they should just snap out of it, that they have control over it. And that, again, would be like asking a person who needs a pacemaker to just get their heart in order and just snap to it and get their heart back on track. You know, this is something that is not based on willpower or a poor ethics or anything like that. This is a real issue that needs treatment and, most importantly, does respond to effective treatment.
How do those in the medical field change the stereotype that depression is an emotion? Because am I wrong that the general public have that emotion? Is it, or have that belief?
I think that is a common misconception. Happiness is an emotion, sadness is an emotion, fear is an emotion, anger is an emotion, and these all have their utilities. Depression is when these things aren't quite working right. It's not an emotion. It's a treatable medical condition. Education. It's hard to get this message out. It's part of what we're doing here today. I think it happens in therapy rooms all over the place, and that's a slow process. It happens at the university level through publications. I think Kim's book is a good example of getting that information out there. It's a team effort.
Dr. Kim Prenberthy, she is a professor at the University of Virginia, a licensed clinical psychologist. Her new book, Persistent Depressive Disorders, I read through that as best I could. Very academic.
Yes.
I don't know all my codes.
It is an academic book. My hope is that if we have family members or people who think they might be suffering from chronic depression, is what we used to call it. We now call it persistent depressive disorder, that they could also find some useful components to this book. At the same time, you're right. It's written for physicians. The book is primarily written for doctors, so they can better understand it because, you know, Rick, we've been talking about the general population. And unfortunately, it's not just the general population who has misconceptions about depression. So I think it was important to write a book for people who might, like primary care doctors, family practice doctors, who might see someone and think perhaps about the fact that this person might be suffering from depression. I think that's so important because I've seen in my career, and I'm sure Niall has as well, people who went undiagnosed for years and thought that this was just the way it had to be. They were very depressed. It was very hard for them to find any joy in living. They had had symptoms for so long, it really disrupted their interpersonal relationships. And so my hope is if we can catch people early, then it doesn't become persistent. If you can catch depression early and get treatment, you don't have to have a life of decades of misery. And my hope is educating both healthcare professionals and the general population will help address this.
We'll get in a little bit more into the academic side as we go along. And Dr. Niall Wagley also here. But let's talk about treatment. How is it approached for help if you have depression and you want to find help? And Dr. Prenberthy, you said that not all doctors are identifying it at its best properly. What is the best way to do that, whether you're doing this individually, whether your family is helping you reach out for help now? What is the best way? Because insurance is also a key factor in this currently, correct? So what do you do?
Absolutely. And I think Niall and I are both going to be talking about this. I'll just start off by saying the best way is to be honest and open with the people you love. If you're suffering from depression or symptoms that we've discussed, and we can discuss those in more detail, fatigue, physical pain. A lot of people with depression have physical pain. They have trouble sleeping. They have trouble with their appetite. And this could be sleeping too much or sleeping too little, eating too much or having no appetite and not eating much. But the most profound is this sense of sadness, hopelessness, helplessness. And as Niall said, we all have that. If we have a loss, like a death in the family, or we lose our job, we get sad. And that typically is an adaptive response that's appropriate. We're talking about sadness like that lasts for 2 weeks or more, For some people, it's lasted years and years. And so that's what we're trying to identify. And I would encourage anyone, if they feel like a loved one is suffering from this, to approach them openly, talk about what they're experiencing, how they see their loved one, you know, feeling or interacting, if they see their loved one withdrawing. And that approach and sort of putting it out on the table is the first thing, because then it allows you to then go to people who can help. There are always depression screening programs going on at public health systems, at the university. You can always speak to your primary care doctor or your family doctor or your nurse. And the most important thing is to bring up the topic and bring up the symptoms that are happening to you or your loved one.
But Dr. Wagley, as someone running their own organization, your own business at Rational Therapeutics, insurance is a key part of that. And as someone, my own belief is that insurance gets in the way of everything. Mm-hmm. And that may not be true for everyone, but if someone is reaching out for assistance, how do you do that with insurance that I believe gets in the way sometimes? I don't know if you agree that that's the case.
I agree that this is a very complex system that does not work well for a lot of folks in a lot of situations. And I and a lot of folks spend a lot of time helping folks navigate a system that people just don't get their needs met medically in a lot of different ways, whether we're talking about depression, heart conditions, other therapies. It's difficult. I agree with that. I spend a lot of time helping folks ask and figure out the answer to that question. We're skipping ahead a little bit, but if we're going to talk about starting to reach out, one of the ways to get help with this would be looking for therapy. If an individual has health insurance, that's a good place to start. Most insurance providers provide a list of who is in their network, and they will get a list. It's not the most helpful list. There's a lot of problems with that list, but it is a good place to start. After that, it's a really good idea to talk to friends. Most people will have dealt with depression at some time in their life. It's not a comfortable thing to do always, but we're proposing that we should talk about depression more. Ask friends, ask relatives, ask people that you know and trust. Who have they talked to? What's been effective for them? Where have they gone to for help? Kind of the third silo in that group of places to look for help is organizations. So I'm thinking of community service boards. Maybe I don't have insurance, or somewhere like Charlottesville Free Clinic, who can assist with folks who may be underinsured or not insured. The Women's Initiative does great work for this kind of thing. There are lots of organizations out there, even without insurance, that we can go to for help.
Again, we are talking about depression today. Our guest, Dr. Niall Wagley, he is a licensed clinical psychologist here in the Charlottesville area at Rational Therapeutics. Our other guest is Dr. Kim Penberthy. She's at UVA, where she's a professor as well as a licensed clinical psychologist. And she's just finished a book, Persistent Depressive Disorders. Let's take a break and come back before we start another question. Hang tight. All right, back again here with our guests, Dr. Kim Penberthy and Dr. Niall Wagley, as we talk about depression. We were going to talk about the mechanisms of cause for depression. Who wants to jump in with that?
I can start, and I'm sure Niall has a lot to add also. We generally think of depression as being caused by multiple components. So we think of it as a biopsychosocial. So that means there are usually biological components that make you vulnerable to depression. So we know there are changes in neurochemicals that are typically related to your genetics. So some of this may be something that you're just preloaded
with.
You mean
you're born with the probable cause of depression?
We call it a vulnerability.
So
right.
It's a genetic thing?
Component, a part of it. So a part of it. And again, the way it happens, we'll explain. So it's like you have these risk factors that alone may or may not impact whether you have depression. It's a combination of them. So, for instance, we've talked about the genetic piece, perhaps, and then there are components from the environment that you were born into. If you were born into an environment that was very impoverished, meaning you didn't have proper nutrition, you had a lot of stress in your life early on, maybe you had exposure to abuse and these sorts of things, and felt helpless, then we see that as adding onto it. And then the larger social context. If you're born as a minority or you're born into an environment where you don't have access to resources, then the larger context of your society, perhaps if you are a victim of biases or racism, then those things add as well. These are all components. So this tripartite, these three pieces all add up. They're all each individual vulnerabilities, which alone might not lead to depression. And yet we conceptualize it that when they all combine, that's often what leads to it. And I think Niall's going to speak a little bit more to that mechanism over time.
So wait a second, Niall. Dr. Wagley, I'll let you get there. I just want to write this down. So there's genetics, right? I just want to put these in easy term for me. There's economics, right?
Well, that's sort of the larger culture. I would think of it as more biological, more psychological. That means the people that raised you, the local environment, and then the larger cultural component. So,
and cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Got it.
And if I were to provide a way of seeing that just from a more individual level, what I would think of is more like this. So we humans have needs. They're pretty easy to understand, and a lot of us think about food, water, shelter, that kind of thing. I need water pretty quickly, and I'm not going to do well without it pretty fast. I can do without food longer than that, but I still need food. I need shelter. I can go a long time without shelter, but pretty soon that's going to start causing me a problem. I think what we don't understand, especially from a psychological perspective, there's a lot more than we need than just food, water, and shelter. So we need a connection to our community. We need a sense that I belong and I contribute to my community. I need a sense of security and safety. I need recreation. Now, these needs I can put off a lot longer than food, water, and shelter. But after a while, if I don't get these things, I'm going to be disappointed. And once I'm disappointed persistently and for too long, I start to get numb. And once I've been numb for too long, certain biological and neurological and other factors, and they happen more if I've got these genetic and other predispositions for it, that's when depression starts to occur.
They all combine and add up. And that's why there are multiple treatment approaches, if you think about it.
All right, yes, because I'm looking down my list of notes, and one of them I was curious about, therapy versus, I guess it's called, in your book, you called it pharmacotherapy. Is that right? But I thought I wrote it down as medication. Is that the same thing?
Yes, it's the same thing.
It's an academic term versus a
correct
guy on the street term.
Right.
But right, therapy versus medication. But is that what we're talking about here? The different treatments versus?
Absolutely. So it helps explain what the data shows. If you look at the research, we found pretty consistently that for people with this long-term depression, a combination of medication to treat the depressive symptoms and psychotherapy are more effective than one of them alone. If that makes sense.
Okay.
Yes. And so we have a good reason to see why that might be. There are multiple components combining to produce depression, so it may take multiple sort of treatment approaches to address it. And if you think about it, there's a third component that you know, a lot of people who are working in public health are trying to approach, which is the larger social community. So that would be the third piece that might really help. If we can lift people out of poverty, if we can help people feel connected more with their community, we know social support is so important to our health and happiness and even our longevity. So that third component, I imagine, over the next decades is going to be even more important, looking at our larger community.
Interesting. Again, our guest today as we talk about depression is Dr. Kim Penberthy and Dr. Niall Wagley. So we talked about genetics being a part, one issue being psychological, another issue being cultural. What part of our community suffers most from possibly all three? Is there a part of the community that suffers more from all three that has depression?
If we're thinking about this as a deficit of needs being met, it would follow that, and the research backs this up solidly, those with the lowest levels to access to resources are those who are most likely to suffer from depression. So we're talking about folks without access to community resources, folks without the same shot at education and jobs. We're talking about folks who have historically been discriminated against, including women and people of color. These are the areas where depression hits the hardest because their needs are least likely to be met.
Absolutely. We see consistently females have higher rates of depression than males in every age group. And we see for age-wise, the 40 to 59-year-old cohort are typically the folks who suffer the most from depression. And there's another myth for you. A lot of people think that older adults might be suffering more, and yet we don't see that in the literature. But certainly people who don't have access to resources, as Niall said, people of color, people with low socioeconomic status across the board, regardless of their race, seem to be more vulnerable to depression.
Well, it seems like that the stereotype is probably the white teen, because they're the ones who go to therapy the most. And maybe that's from the movies or something, but it here sounds like what I'm hearing is that blacks and Asians and Hispanics are probably, and maybe women, due to the gender, are more likely to be suffering from depression.
And I would again give the caveat. The common theme through many of them is low support in the environment. So low socioeconomic status, they don't have power economically, they don't maybe have connections socially. So that seems to be a component. And if you think about how we think depression comes about, you can look at it and see that makes sense. If we say that this vulnerability is related to not being respected in your community, not having resources, having a difficult and challenging time, being victims of abuse or bias, then you can see why that one certain population might be more vulnerable, the low socioeconomic status person or the low social status person is the person. And in our culture, those seem to be women and people of color.
How about again, our guests today are, as we talk about depression, Dr. Niall Wagley and Dr. Kim Penberthy, both of whom are licensed clinical psychologists. Dr. Penberthy at UVA, Dr. Wagley at Rational Therapeutics. Does depression have we continue to talk about the cons. Are there any pros that go with it, sort of learning about yourself, possibly?
I can speak to that. The short answer is not really. There are some real pros to negative emotions. So that's what sadness is good for. When we become sad, we do become more creative. There's a utility there. It helps me figure out problems. When I become angry, it helps me get my needs met. If my behaviors are appropriate behind that anger, fear helps me protect myself. Like, there are some real advantages and adaptive features to our emotions. That's why it's important to acknowledge emotions, be aware of emotions, listen to emotions, talk and express emotions. Depression is when those emotions are not answered well and it starts to become non-adaptive. It does not help. It makes things worse. That's where this spiral happens, and that's one of the reasons that depression has been so notoriously difficult to treat. It's kind of a catch-22. The thing that I really need to do is hard for me to do. I need to get up and interact with other people, but I don't feel like interacting with people. I need to get some exercise, but I don't feel like exercising. I feel fatigued and unable to do the things that I need to do that would help me get my needs met. That's why what Dr. Penberthy was saying is so important. This needs to be addressed earlier in the stages of depression. Prevention is very important. It's way better to not get here than to try to fix it. There aren't a lot of advantages of being depressed, if any, that I can think of right now.
And I think it's important what Niall brings up, the distinction between feeling depressed, depressed feelings in response to something, and what we're perceiving as a mental disorder of being depressed clinically. So there is a point where it crosses over, and certainly I would back up exactly what Dr. Wagley said, that the disease of depression, we don't learn anything. We don't have a personal growth from that necessarily. That's really a disorder.
And this may touch on some of the educational pieces of this and just syntax. I think I hear that a lot. People say, oh, I'm so depressed that I got a bad grade, or I'm so depressed that I don't get to go to the movies tonight, or I'm so depressed. Like, that's not the right word for that. It's okay to use that, but I think it's important to know that that's not depression. That's disappointment or frustration. Those are reasonable and appropriate emotions to have after something like that disappointing happens, but that's not depression.
Dr. Penberthy, in your book, you list that there are eight distinct depressive disorders. Can we talk about some of those for a bit and explain, without getting too academic?
Absolutely.
Let's remember that this is a 101 class for everyone, and we're not all licensed psychologists who already know the grade.
Absolutely.
But I did write down that one common feature is being sad and empty and in irritable mood.
Absolutely.
And so let's go forward from there and some of the basics.
Absolutely. So that's interesting that you picked up on the irritability, because there's a cluster of symptoms that we typically associate with depression, with a clinical depression, if you will. That means a depression that's, we can diagnose and say, yes, this has moved from sadness and response to a sad thing happening to a real depression that we need to treat. So a lot of times people expect the sadness, the tearfulness, those sorts of emotions. That's often common in probably the majority of people. There can also be a demonstration of irritability. And often we might see this, for instance, in men more than women, where they're very depressed and it shows through their irritability. So they become much more short with people, they're crankier, and this is a manifestation of depression. And for me, I listed all of these various kinds of depression in that book so that it helps the physicians, again, to know what they're looking for and how to identify it. I speak with my patients about the fact that it's in some ways less important what we call it and most important that we address it as a serious disorder that has effective treatments.
When you start talking about them, you list that the difference among the eight is the timing of the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chronicity. I want to define that quickly.
Right. So we typically think of depression as either short term, so that might be acute. So we call those things like major depressive episodes where you get very depressed for a circumscribed period of time. It has to be 2 weeks or longer. And so we've seen people that go into a major depression and then they may cycle out of it, come out of it, and be okay. That's short term. So it's still severe. We still want to treat it. Then there is this whole other category that the chronicity means it's long. So it persists for a long time. And that includes something called dysthymia, which is a long-term sort of low-grade depression that persists. And in the past, people have thought about this as less serious. However, we are changing our minds about that because it's not quite, the symptoms are not quite as severe, and yet they persist for decades. And it's like a slow grinding down of your ability to be resilient. You just, you know, if you think about it, if you are feeling a little depressed or moderately depressed for 20 years, you can see how that would wear you down to the point where it's very difficult to function. So we basically think of them as a sort of short-term depressions or long-term depressions. And you can have them overlapping. So you could have someone with this chronic depression and then more severe episodes on top of it. So they're depressed all along. They have a major depressive episode and they get more depressed. And they come back out of that, but they're still depressed. That's a big component of the folks that I work with, for sure.
You also mentioned that one more difference is a presumed etiology. Define etiology for us.
So this means sort of the things we were talking about earlier, the causes. So we know that different kinds of depression may have more differences in what's predominantly causing them, if that makes sense. So,
yeah. All right. So we'll come back. There's eight different ones. We won't talk about all eight of them, but there's a couple here that I do want to get in touch with. And then a couple more questions about some treatment. I want to know if there's relapses. We talk about 2 weeks. 2 years. I want to know about, we've yet to give out any referral numbers and a couple other things. So hang tight, everybody. Again, we're talking about depression with Dr. Penberthy and Dr. Wagley. All right. So we're back. Sunday morning wake up call. As we're talking about depression, I've already learned that so many people get depression in their lifetime. This is not a certain percentage that are born with it. You're going to get this. It's not something that you eat too much and so you're going to have diabetes. This is something that for many reasons this happens to you in your life. Then, as I learned during this break, I asked who's got the referral numbers, and let's toss those out now. But only a third of people go to get treatment. So who's got a basic referral number or two? And certainly there are more referral numbers in places than you can go, and it shouldn't take a lot of effort to Google your referral number or place to get started, but a basic referral number or place.
And let me start off by saying, because of the complex nature of what we're talking about, there's just not one right answer for an individual. And this isn't one right, there's not one right treatment center, there's not one correct treatment modality. Like, this is complex. But I hear what you're saying, and I think it's a good question. How does someone get started, and what are some ideas about some places to start to reach out for some help? The reason I'm mentioning this is it would be easy to end up in a place, your first try not being a good try, and then the person give up and give up looking for services and not get what they need. So I think it's important to remember that those who get good help are those that keep trying and keep looking for a good treatment modality for themselves with the particular thing that they're dealing with at the time.
Absolutely. So I would advocate, if you have insurance, go to your insurance website and look at who is providing treatment. That's a good place to start. And like Niall said, you might have to try a few different places. Often people are full, are not accepting new patients, but you will find somebody. If you don't have insurance, I would advocate reaching out to the local free clinic. We have Charlottesville Free Clinic, which is 296-5525. And they will also have access to resources. If you want to look at the Region 10, which is our local community board, they provide mental health and substance abuse and counseling services as well as medication. And you can find their number in your local county. Each county has one of these. And then, of course, the University of Virginia is often a fabulous place to start, because if they can't help you, they can find out who can. And we have a great system of clinics there. And so reaching out to those folks, the number for one of our clinics that can sort of help guide you through that is at the Northridge offices out there near, sort of past the Boar's Head. And that number is 243-4646.
And I'll speak up and say a couple of other folks that I've worked closely with in the past, and I've seen folks get good results, especially for students and faculty and staff members at the university. There is a faculty and employee assistance program. They're good folks doing really good work. I've worked with them before, and a lot of it's an easy place to go quickly for assistance. 434-243-2643. And specifically for students through CAPS, that's the UVA student health system. They have some really good therapists over there that can help get students started who just need to talk to someone quickly. 434-243-5150.
And the show will be podcast if you're just walking in late, or we gave out numbers and everything too quickly and you're trying to scroll it down and listen to the podcast. You're welcome to go back and check it out and replay it. So again, our guest today, Dr. Kim Penberthy from the University of Virginia, Dr. Niall Wagley from Rational Therapeutics. So, Dr. Penberthy, let's go back. We were talking about your book, Persistent Depressive Disorders, and where you had listed 8 distinct depressive disorders. And the fact that they had a common feature of being sad and empty and irritable moods, and but some of the differences being chronicity and the timing of the symptoms and the presumed etiology. But one of the things that caught my attention, let me find the one. You listed that one of them you could have psychotic features.
Correct.
So talk about that for a moment.
So we see that a certain number, it's certainly a lower number of patients with depression, become so severely depressed that they literally are not thinking accurately anymore. So they may have symptoms of paranoia and thoughts that don't really match reality. And we would call this a psychotic depression. This is typically associated with very, very severe symptoms of depression. And obviously, this needs to be treated quite quickly. And the good news is, with treatment, the psychotic symptoms, those symptoms of not thinking right or being paranoid, go away. And especially they sort of go away earlier even than the other depressive symptoms. So if you have a loved one, someone you know who's experiencing this, it would be very important to get them in. And I would advocate going to an emergency room, because these symptoms can be very severe and very frightening, and they also can be treated pretty quickly. So that the person starts to feel better and then can get treatment for the underlying depression.
And these should be differentiated, I think, from primary psychotic disorders. So this isn't an individual who has schizophrenia or something like this. This should be thought of as the edges or the top levels of some very severe depressions. Like Kim said, with treatment, we can get someone off of the edges very, very effectively. And that's the difference. This is not someone who is needs an antipsychotic medication immediately necessarily. This is someone who's not thinking correctly because of the extreme and severe level of the depression that's occurring at the time.
I also saw anxious distress. Can you explain what's... I won't claim to know the difference in a lot of these things or where they fall in some. Can you please explain?
Absolutely. I think it's important to remember most people who suffer from depressive symptoms also have symptoms of anxiety, and these seem to go hand in hand. So the one you pointed out is sort of a differentiation where maybe the majority of their symptoms are more this anxiety that they present initially. I think, though, it is important to remember that most of the people who suffer from depression have symptoms of anxiety also, and that's going to be a component that does improve over time. And sometimes it's identified as a separate disorder, but often it's really seen as part of the depression and the way that that is coming up for that individual. And I think there's one other component that I'm sure your listeners are anticipating is the bipolar component. So my book is describing primarily people with depression, and we think of that as a mood disorder that's really with only depressive symptoms. And there are mood disorders, meaning, you know, obviously disorders of regulation of your mood, that include depression and this sort of hypomanic or manic symptoms also. And we would think, we call that a bipolar disorder. And so there, you know, are listeners who may be aware of this. And I think it's important to acknowledge that that is, exists as well.
And there's another one here. Major depressive episode. I'm not sure what double depression is.
So I alluded to this earlier. We can think again of chronicity. How long are the symptoms lasting? So a major depressive episode is a very severe, deep depression. We say it's an episode if it lasts 2 weeks or more. Often for people, it can last much longer than that. And then the double depression is when you have that major depressive episode on top of that dysthymia, that, remember, that sort of chronic low-grade depression that goes on for 2 years or more. And again, for many of the people I see, it's lasted much longer than 2 years. So when you have both of them combined, we call that double depression, because you've got one and then another. And it is a double doozy. It's really serious.
An individual with dysthymia or this type of depression is much more likely to get the major depressive episode. For what we said earlier, I'm less likely to get my needs met if I'm chronically low-grade depressed for a lot of my life. I'm more likely to get more depressed and have one of these major depressive dips.
Is there... When you talk about major depressive episode, when we talk about, when I bring up, because they're the more interesting terms, psychotic features, anxious distress, And earlier in the conversation, the hour, we brought up the fact that women are more likely to have be sufferers of depression. Are women more likely to be sufferers of these? And I don't point that out because I want somebody to make fun. I just bring that up because is that something that happens?
I think with all of these things we're talking about, there's no simple cause. There's lots of causes. And anytime there are stressors on a system, there's going to be more likely to be problems, such as the ones we're talking about.
I mean, you said men are more likely to be irritable.
So we do see across the board that these seem to happen more in females. And, you know, we have some different hypotheses. Again, like Niall was saying, women have traditionally been able to access fewer resources. They may have other hormonal issues. Remember, we're thinking of a tripartite, three components. So
Yeah. Are
there genetics, hormonal components that happen? Again, in females, perhaps. And we just don't know a lot of this. Again, it's this complex combination of, maybe women don't have time to go and see a doctor because they're working full time. They're a full time wife. They're a full time mother. They're a full time caregiver for elderly parents.
Perhaps I'm in a certain group that says that it's not okay to ask for help for therapy, or perhaps I'm in a certain group that says it's not okay to have problems. You need to be strong. There's a lot of things that could keep someone from getting the help they need once this happens, and a lot of things that could contribute to a person getting this, even in certain groups, from the beginning.
Are there different? Well, I guess that would be a coping style, but I found that phrase in the book as well. Are there different coping styles for different genders, for different socioeconomic status?
I would say they're not necessarily different coping styles, that there's access to different methods of coping. So if you don't have access to supportive people who can help you work through something or find resources, then you are at a disadvantage. And we know, for instance, that increasingly social support from trusted others, even if they're not healthcare providers or mental health care providers, is a very important factor in overall mental health. And if you don't have access to that, then you may be at a disadvantage and be more vulnerable.
And instead of breaking it down into coping styles for different groups, we could talk about coping styles for individuals. And it's going to be different for every individual. But if I'm depressed and if I need to start thinking about treatment and how to get it, that's a long process and a complex process. Before that, there's some things that we can just do on our own. These aren't easy things to do. In fact, it's one of the things that's the hardest to do while I have depression. But these are things such as, even though I don't feel like it, get outside and get some sun. Even though I don't feel like it, try to get some movement of any kind. Even though I don't feel like it, try to be around good people and get good support. These little simple things to feel a little bit better to help start to increase my mood so that I have my better chances of getting help in the long run.
Now, one of the things that we haven't touched on within the hour is children. And, you know, by children, I mean younger than some crack I made about teenagers during the hour. Mm-hmm. Is there anything special or different about children? Do children suffer from depression?
Absolutely.
Could you talk about that for the brief time we have left?
Absolutely. I'll be quick and let Niall talk as well. The common approach is to think of this as really a disorder of childhood. Most people with, at least for chronic depression, persistent depressive disorder start when people are young and they don't get treated. So if you think about who is our most vulnerable population, it's children. They can't control the environment they're in, the resources they access, the support they get. They have no control. They're totally vulnerable. And so absolutely, we know depression occurs in children, and it often persists, especially if it's not treated.
The only thing I'll add to that, and I agree 100%, is that what that means is the outcome is a systemic approach. We need to think about the needs that children have and how to get those met on a cultural and societal standpoint.
And the families that go with these folks are often, we often talk about the individuals, but the families are just as challenged.
Yes, absolutely. And they need support as well. And most of the good resources that we've provided will know that and will include them in the work that they do with the person who's presenting with the depression.
Our guest today, again, Dr. Kim Penberthy, where she's a professor and a licensed clinical psychologist at the University of Virginia. Her book, Persistent Depressive Disorders, and Dr. Niall Wagley, also a licensed clinical psychologist, and his business, Rational Therapeutics, where he's taught courses at UVA and VCU. And you can find the business at www.rationaltherapeutics.com. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Next week, Small Business Administration and a couple local businesses. Take care, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.